The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening! You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 15. And this is the inaugural episode of our new season of thrills, chills, and things that'll make you go, ick, but in a good way. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing two tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Carol Ann Brenneman and Warren Benedetto. Tonight we'll hear stories of underground oddities and beastly burrowers. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. What things lurk for you as we start a new season? Well, why not look into that deep hole in the mountainside? You know the one that yawns into the darkness and seems to lead just about anywhere. Who knows how far it goes or what secrets it contains? Just hope nothing closes you off from the world above, or decides it wants to try surface food and see how different it tastes. Tonight we have a fine tale for you from Carol Ann Brenneman regarding a tale of a lost brother and a search down into the depths of a quiet town. The deep depths, in fact, that lead to an ancient legend that no one ever wants to meet. Without further ado, I present to you Birchwood Jack. Beware of claw and ivory teeth, from he who sleeps so deep beneath. Antlers adorn his faceless smile, jeer his name if you have the guile. In caves of old, those who dare wander never need more these fools to ponder. All poor souls who wind up dead, their graves he'll mark with leaves of red. Our luck, our life, our worries wait on Birchwood Jack, who seals our fate. August shouldn't bite like this, I remember thinking. There shouldn't have been that chill in the air. Lots of things shouldn't have happened that summer, but as I stood there in the new windbreaker jacket my mom had given me right before it all went wrong, I reminded myself that Waterbury wasn't Galveston, and New Hampshire was an entirely different sort of beast than Texas. It was a creature of subtlety, of jagged lands and forests, that made a Western boy feel smothered and claustrophobic. Out west, the land always bared itself to you. She had nothing to hide. She called for you. She welcomed you in. But Waterbury? Oh, she had plenty to hide, I never did trust her, never could. She was a deceptive land that hid her faults well beneath scrunched ways of earth, and forests grown thick like picket fences for her secrets to dwell, within forever undisturbed from light and decency. I hated the way that her winters came so early and fierce, bringing that dark and biting cold storming back into the world like it never truly left. Plenty seem to find beauty there, but they are far more trusting than I. No, me, I would have drowned in those woods. I hated it, truly. Most ironically, I never think it bothered Sammy. Oh, Sammy, I'm sorry. He'd only been one when we left home. I don't think he was ever able to remember it. And that summer, the summer we lost him, he'd only been six. Just six. Came out of his way only because my dad and mom had both just gotten laid off. They were unemployed and they had enough money left for exactly one cross-country Hail Mary. It was my aunt's fault, really. She and her husband had called Waterbury their home since before I was born, and she always sung its praises. They pressed the issue. "Everything grows there," she'd say to my mother. "But I'm not talking plants, though. I'm sure they do quite fine, too. The forests are beautiful. I really mean the people. I tell you, it's like it's in the air, Sal. Everything just goes your way. The town's booming, bustling. Harry's garage has been going just as strong now as the day he opened it, which is to say we really have no complaints. You two must give it a look." And with no jobs, two kids, hopes for a third, and a house they could barely afford to begin with, well, there really was only one option, and they took it. I know it wasn't my aunt's fault, how it all ended. She didn't know what was going to happen. She wasn't of old Waterbury stock. Really, I could never fault my parents either for finding the town of Waterbury quaint and hospitable. It's one of those places that just feels so perfectly cut off from all of the worst parts of the world. No crime, no drugs, it wore no signs on its pristine face. "Welcome to Waterbury," it greeted you on a great painted sign as you drove into town. "Home of the American Dream." It sought to make good on that promise. It was a town where people made it their business to learn a person's name, where they'd bring you warm homemade pies and casseroles if you were new in town, or if somebody in the family had fallen ill. Waterbury was a town so safe that my mom let me and Sammy wander wherever we pleased, so long as we stuck together, of course. It's a rare kind of town. For that, I would consider us all very lucky. Over the years, I've learned so much, and like most, I've had my fair share of illusions shattered. Waterbury was the first. Waterbury was the town that taught me that there's only one difference between the picturesque American storybook town and everywhere else, and that's how good you are at sweeping your mess under the rug. As transfixed as we all were, I think Sammy was the most enchanted of us all. Waterbury was home to him. He loved it. He loved the trees and the colors they made in the fall. He loved the quiet brook behind our house and the round stones he'd pull from its banks. He collected those. I still have some of them. Dozens and dozens of these perfectly smooth rocks. I remember the laugh he made running down that hill on Sycamore Street, just right around the corner from our house on the way home from school. "Watch how fast I can go, Johnny. Faster and faster." Just a boy having fun, his light-up shoes blinking every step of the way. Just a boy with the best smile in the world. A smile that, on that chilly August evening, I carried with me in a stack of maybe 4 dozen desperate flyers. A smile that sat frozen beneath big words in bold type. "Have you seen me?" It was a Friday. Sammy had disappeared on that previous Sunday. Every boy has nightmares when he falls asleep, and not all of them are unlucky enough to wake up to one. Not every boy knows that the cold that skitters under your skin when your mom starts to scream and tremble, and when your father starts running, his usually calm and stalwart composure suddenly shattered like the walls of a sandcastle, yielding to the tides. It's a feeling you can't wake from. It's like your life has ended, and your body refuses to rot, to release your soul. You're just trapped in the aftermath of your own demise. That's what it's like to lose a brother. No one knew for sure what had happened. At least that's what the adults claimed. There'd been no sign of struggle in his room. His sheets were folded, his shoes missing. The window had been securely locked, but there was never a moment that I didn't believe that Sammy had been taken. The other children believed so, too. The children all knew as they sang their little rhymes. Regardless, we looked everywhere that week under the assumption that Sammy must have strayed away. We scoured the town. We combed the woods. We'd hung so many of those flyers that I don't think there was a single telephone pole unadorned by Sammy's face. But a week had passed, and we'd heard nothing, and we found nothing. The only reason I was in the park was because I no longer had any sort of idea what to do. All logical options had been expended, so I'd given way to fantasy. I had this idea, these visions, I guess, of my brother playing on the swings or maybe going down one of the slides. It seemed so nice. It felt so real. I wanted it so, so badly. Then I thought maybe I'd see him walk out of those trees by the edge of the park, or that maybe I'd find him by the monkey bars or over by the baseball field. He'd be dirty, he'd be scared, but he'd see me, and he'd know it'd be okay. He'd know that I never stopped looking. The swings were empty. The slides were empty. A flock of geese did amble about the old rusty monkey bars, but there was no one else there. No one at the baseball field. I was alone in the park that evening. Sammy wasn't there. And over by the trees? No one stood there waiting for me, of course. No one and nothing. Except for one peculiar tree that caught my eye. Tired and wandering for so long, I hadn't realized that this thing had caught me in its orbit until I'd nearly walked right into it. I hadn't noticed it because I hadn't been looking for it. I didn't expect it to be there. This tree stood apart from his compatriots, sticking up almost defiantly through the earth. A forgotten monument, a lone headstone. It was a small tree in height, only standing about 2 of me tall, but as thick as maybe 3 of me around the base. It reminded me of a crochet needle, the way it tapered off to a point at the top. It had no branches, it had no leaves, just a solid conical trunk. I'd seen trees like that before, trees that had been struck by lightning, split by that force of heat and fire, until there was nothing left but the bladed edges of bark fixed to the ground. But this tree didn't bear those ashen scars of fire and fury. This tree was pale and as smooth as carved ivory. It never crossed my mind what kind of tree it was. I was 13, I didn't care. Nor had I wondered whether or not I'd never seen it there before. It was just a tree. A tree with perfect, naked bark at the center of a spotlight. Perfect place for me to put one of those flyers. I took my time stapling it to the tree's flesh. When I was done, Sammy stared back at me and I was caught, as I was always caught, in those bright eyes. Tears responded in my own eyes, but I didn't let them show. I had to be a man, and I had such a boyish idea of precisely what that meant. Now that I'm older, I think about how much I should have let myself feel. I think of those emotions I should have let out instead of holding to fester within. Emotions whose rot I'm still trying to scrape from my veins. I'm not ashamed to admit that his voice made me jump. Hey, kid, park's closed after sunset. It's about time to be getting home. I hadn't noticed the cop pull into the parking lot, nor had I heard him walking up behind me. Worst of all, I hadn't realized that the light had been faded, swallowed somewhere deep in that forever forest. World and time had slipped away. "Yeah," I said, as talkative as any teenager. "Sorry." "No need to be sorry, kid," he said with an amicable grin. "Sure, your parents would appreciate you getting home at a reasonable hour, right?" I nodded, although I'm sure my face showed hints of that teenage petulance that naturally surges in opposition to any adult assertion. I knew it was not something to debate. Once again, I was just a child, and there comes such a helplessness in that, such a feeling of bitter ineptitude. The cop, whose name I no longer remember, knew who I was, at least. He tried to strike up a conversation with me the entire way out of the park. "Cry in shame," he said in the fragments that I could remember, "along with good kid, too, and doing our best to find him, don't you worry." It was his tone I found most offensive. To act like we're buddies. To act like things were fine when he was the one who was supposed to be out there. To be searching. When he was one of those magical perfect cops that everyone assured me, again and again, would be the ones to fix everything. To solve it, to find Sammy. Instead of any of that, here's this guy making small talk with me in the park. I wanted to hit him. "But either way, you should go on home before it gets too dark, kid. Night's Jack's hours, and you should get some sleep." I scoffed. "Yeah, thanks." "Those are the only two words you know, kid?" To which I said, of course, "Yeah, thanks," before riding off and out of sight on my bike. The cop stayed in that park until I was out of sight, but it was his words that followed me home. His words, tuned in my head, and a name nipping at my heels. Jack's hours. Jack. 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 Another thing I hate about the Northeast. History. Every place has a history. Lord knows Texas has its share. But I feel that when you find yourself in the cradle of the United States, history is old enough to become a legend. And that's when it becomes something overwhelming. Legends grow there tall like trees, but at that speed, and with a suffocating grip of vines. They burrow into the soil like roots, holding firm to a region, and they cast their shadow over places for generations. You find these places where everyone has their own local tales and their own local boogeymen. Waterbury was no exception. Waterbury was home to quite the tale of its own, one that had haunted me from the moment I set foot in that accursed place. One that the locals hold to fondly and the kids whisper in dark places. Their boogeyman went by the name of Birchwood Jack. It was once a colonial soldier, an old general, they'd say, named Jack, who had such a penchant for bloodlust that he'd take bites out of the flesh of his enemies in the heat of battle. It became so extreme that he soon found himself discharged from the colonial army and left with nothing but a hunger that he couldn't truly satisfy. That is, until he found his calling on the early American frontier. He helped purge the lands around the town of Waterbury of the native people who called it home. More than that, according to legend, this savage took his hunger to a new level as he began to devour any poor souls to which he laid slaughter. A bloodthirsty madman. He eventually threw off the chains of civilized society quite intentionally, preferring to instead dwell within a narrow and twisty granite cave that lay beneath the foundations of Waterbury itself. It was there that the fearsome General Jack became so engorged upon the flesh of his victims that one day he found himself unable to exit that cave at all. His home had become his prison, and there was no escape. But that wasn't the end for old Jack, because This is where the legend claims that the old general was not discouraged by his predicament. In fact, it's said that his hunger and his stature only grew and grew. They say his hunger was so great, not even God could pry him from this land, and that there was no space in hell for a creature the size of him. So he was left to carve out his home beneath Waterbury, and over the centuries, without sun, his skin would thicken with calluses to such a rigid pallor that it would resemble only the tips of the birch trees that ran along the Roanoke River, giving him the name Birchwood Jack. And through the years, he kept feasting upon the unwary and lonely travelers, tricking many with the wag of his devilish fingers to enter his lair, which no one would ever emerge again. It was children he favored most of all, they said. Children who made the acquaintance of Birchwood Jack could satisfy his hunger in a way no one else could. It's why, only in Waterbury, New Hampshire, the kids would teach you a very special rhyme. A silly little thing meant to keep curious eyes out of the dark nooks and crannies where they shouldn't be. Not that there were actually any caves around Waterbury. I'd always been told that any there had been blasted out of existence back in the late 1800s. Legends often have a way of outliving their usefulness. Bunch of nonsense. Home was empty. Home was quiet. Mom and Dad were out, of course, searching. The note on the table let me know they were out with my aunt and the search team in the southwestern stretch of woods. There was an expansive gorge there with a swift undercurrent in the waters below. It'd be the last place we'd want to find them, but they were dredging the river by the time I put that note back down on the table and had tried to find some way to pass the time. It all felt so useless, so unimportant. I was unimportant. What was I supposed to do? Watch TV? Tried that, flipped through maybe 24 channels before I decided that I needed to keep my legs moving. I hadn't slept or eaten in almost a week, and the urge to do so would not return. What was there? Jack. It called to me, my restless mind and body unwilling to let it fade. The name, the dark, thoughts of tunnels and caves, the basement. We'd searched there, of course, and the crawl space. Sammy hadn't been there. There was no point in looking again. There's an itch inside a child's mind, I think. One that makes us susceptible. One that has a strange attraction to fear. An emotion we'd just begun to understand. It was magnetic. Electric. It was silly and ridiculous, so of course I did it. Of course, I surrendered to the absurd. Of course, I entered the basement. I had to see what answers held in the dark. Boxes. That's what our basement was. Boxes atop a cold concrete floor covered in dust, dead bugs, and more dust. I hated going down there. I moved them all, the large and the small. I turned boxes over, emptying boxes out, like there was any chance that Sammy could be hiding underneath or inside any 3x3 shipping box. I don't know what I expected to find. I don't think I really expected a damn thing. I was moving in the same frantic way you do when you've misplaced your keys in the morning and you're going to be late for work. I expected nothing, but as I worked my way into the furthest, mustiest corner, the unexpected happened. I found something. Growing in that lonely corner in the basement, in the dark, in the damp, was a single, wiry sapling, a young weed weaving its way out of a crack in the basement floor. I'd never seen a plant like it, a pale white stem that contrasted so perfectly with those dark, stunning leaves, leaves of perfect crimson. My breath caught. The echoes of a rhyme floated in my head. Their graves he'll mark with leaves of red. I turned around quick enough to make me dizzy and lightheaded, just to prove I was still alone, affirming that no one else was there. I turned back to that eerily unnatural plant, that intruder. I reached out to touch it, but the moment I did, I recoiled so quickly, like the plant had been a rattlesnake that had just lashed out and bit me. I just hadn't been expecting it, was all. The leaf was warm, almost hot to the touch. It wasn't right. It wasn't normal. Reaching out once more, I slowly moved past the leaves and sought to grab the plant around its stem, tenderly, cautiously. I didn't know if I thought it was going to creep away like a centipede, or if I expected to be covered in needles like a stinging nettle. My grip was firm, and I examined the curious plant closely. I couldn't tell what it was. I'd never seen anything like it before. Then, with a sickening twinge, I discovered that I could feel a thrumming in my hand. Whether it was my own pulse I felt in my white-knuckled grip, or that of an alien weed, I still can't say. I still don't like to think about it, even if I have my honest and horrid suspicions. I gave the weed a solid tug, testing its depth and hold. It moved a bit within that crack in the ground, but even more importantly, the crack moved too. More accurately, it was the concrete beside the plant that had shifted. It was just a tiny bit, but definitely noticeable. When I pulled on the strangely living sapling, it felt and looked like a bit of the concrete floor wanted to lift as well. Traced the crack as it arced around and slithered beneath some other old boxes, and with haste I released the plant and I shoved and kicked those old boxes away. The mess I had made was inconsequential. What mattered was clearing the path of the breach within the floor. In the end, I discovered that Fissure had carved out a slab of concrete shaped like a U, measuring maybe less than a yard across the floor. With another firm tug of the red-leafed plant, I found my hunch to be right in that the entire slab could be raised. I barely remember what happened next, or the thoughts that went through my head. The thrill of discovery dosed my veins with gasoline and struck a match. My breaths hissed like steam as I took my father's crowbar, jammed it down into the concrete, and wedged it straight through the crack beside the plant. Pried it back and forth, up and down, until I felt that the leverage was just right, and I pushed. I pushed that crowbar harder than I've ever pushed anything in my life, and as that slab of concrete lifted free from the earth, I pushed it over onto the floor where it landed with a solid thunk. Beneath where that slab had lay, there was a hole in the earth that stretched down far into the soil. A hole that in that moment I knew I would have to go into. It was obvious in the heat of the moment. My parents were out of reach and wouldn't be home for hours. The neighbors were out. I knew they'd be. The first football game of the year was that night. Half the town would be at that game. I didn't even think about calling the cops. Maybe it's because I didn't think it would really go anywhere, I'd lie. Truthfully, maybe I just wanted to play the hero. I grabbed my dad's metal flashlight, for emergencies only, and I found where my mom had stashed some of her old EMT gear, including something that I don't think they ever knew we still had, a bright orange flare gun. Armed with nothing but light and that old flare gun with only one round to spare, I descended into hell. At least that's how it felt the moment I realized just how deep the narrow tunnel stretched and how it felt the moment the light of the basement no longer warmed me overhead. For the first 10, maybe 15 meters, I felt like I'd wedged myself through like a mole, descending feet first through an opening no larger than a crawl space. I had to wiggle and shimmy, and all the while I started to call out, "Sammy! Sammy?" Nothing. Not even the echo of my own voice returned my cry as I came out into a passageway significantly larger than the one that wormed its way up to my house. I'd slipped into a round tunnel of pale and splotchy granite that snaked along ahead of me for maybe 200 meters. I could stand, I could move, but I didn't know if I could run. The thought of running entered my mind right then, of turning around and climbing back out. But this felt like it. This felt like the answer I'd been looking for. This felt right in all the wrong ways. My body didn't want to go, but my heart told me that if I wanted to find Sammy, this was what I needed to do. Step by step, I left the entrance and the strange red leaf plant behind, and I willingly embraced that terrible silence with nothing but the constant repeating thumming in my head. In caves of old, for those dare wander, never need more these fools to ponder. The system was more expansive than I could ever have imagined. What started with a section that I thought would go on for a few hundred meters quickly turned into this intricate network of numerous twisting, winding, and intersecting pathways that felt like they'd been carved out of the granite walls around me. That was a thought I didn't have until much later, and one that has haunted me every moment since. Every time I picture those round, smooth walls, I realize I must have been so spectacularly blind. Those tunnels had been carved by hand. In the spaces where the cave grew damp, natural groundwater seeping in through the worn walls, I worried for my footing. The ground was nearly as smooth as the walls, and it wouldn't take much for the traction to disappear from under me. There was an understanding that in those spaces where the cavern floor sloped down, if I were to lose my footing, then everything would be over. The further I went in, the faster I wanted to go, but I was held back by the knowledge that one false move could lead me to a potentially disastrous, crippling slip and render me utterly unable to escape. There was another thing I should have realized in the moment, specifically in that moment that I made my first turn into a new tunnel and left the old one behind. I hadn't any way to find my way out. Those tunnels were all so identical, with no noticeable or defining features. I was in a labyrinth, and I was no Theseus. It was a mistake that would come back to bite me, and a mistake I've relived again and again in so many countless nightmares. The fact I'm alive to tell this story at all. Regardless, how long must I have searched down there, calling Sammy's name in the dark? 10 minutes? 30? Had an hour passed. Time's a luxury for those who can follow the lights that move across the sky. In the dark beneath the earth, it has no meaning. It did not exist. I journeyed and journeyed until I realized I was just wandering. And so I wandered until that wandering grew into worry. And I worried until that worry spoiled into panic. Lefts became rights, backs became fronts. And in the depths beneath Waterbury, I became so utterly and hopelessly lost. If I'd thought that the woods and hills of New Hampshire had made me claustrophobic, well, then I had so much to learn. My panic caught a hold of me and silenced my voice. Instead of hoping to find Sammy, I selfishly started to hope I wouldn't find anything. Or better said, I hoped that nothing would find me. Because there were moments, definitely moments, where I could swear that I heard footsteps that did not belong to me. Countless paranoid shines of the flashlight behind me always revealed nothing but empty space. Real or not, I could feel my sanity very rapidly bleeding away. In the dark, that name found me again, and I started to hum. The only way to keep my teeth from rattling inside my skull. The only way to keep my soul from popping out of the goose flesh on my arms. It was a nervous tick, a fretful motif. I couldn't stop. Beware of claw and ivory teeth. Direction became meaningless from he who sleeps so deep beneath. Nothing felt real. Our luck, our life, our worries wait. I desperately wanted to run, but the risk. I'm Birchwood Jack, who seals our fate. A warm breeze fell upon my neck like a breath, and I immediately decided, all risk be damned, I had to run. I broke out into a stumbling, awkward sprint as I succumbed to pure instinct. I had to keep my head down. I needed to stay on my feet. More than that, I needed an exit, any exit. I needed the way back, but back was the one place I dared not look. I descended even deeper. Lost in my panic, all focus had vanished. I'd stopped paying close enough attention to where I was stepping. I stepped on something soft, and the awkward way it yielded underfoot caught me off guard and sent me hurtling forward onto the ground. I'd been lucky the tunnel was moderately level in that direction, so I skidded to an almost immediate tumble and stop. My knees ached. I'd torn a hole right through my jeans. My palms were skinned and bloody. I was certain I had glanced the wall with my forehead, and the flashlight had tumbled to a stop about 5 feet to my right. There was no time for pain, however, no time to hesitate. I leapt across the cavern floor for that light like it was my life raft in an open sea, the only thing keeping me from drowning in the dark. It wasn't the only light left in that tunnel. As I wheeled around, wielding my beam of light like the blade of a sword, I cast the shadows out of the, fortunately, empty cavern way, and I saw it. I had been in such a rush, I hadn't noticed what I'd tripped over. It illuminated the tunnel with a strobing red and blue flicker. It was one of Sammy's shoes. My heart shattered. I scrambled over it, shaking on hands and knees like a feral beast. Like all cruel things in life, it was like holding an impossibility in my hands. It was there. I could feel it, but my brain refused to acknowledge it. I put the flashlight under my arm and I held his toe, tapping the sole against the heel of my palm, causing the lights to dance once more. I'd been close. I'd been so close. Closer than anyone else, but I was still far too late. The shoes were caked in it, the only clue to an unspoken yet undeniable fate. They were caked in dry old blood. It was worse than any nightmare. The worst moment of my life, and yet it was a blessing. There was more resolution than my mother and father would ever get. Sammy, oh my Sammy. I was still so sorry. Everything flowed out of me, then in tremorous waves. Tears, hot enough to burn, flowed down my cheeks. I couldn't breathe as my body heaved and heaved again. The dark felt like a living creature all around me, but one that mercifully granted me a moment of time in which to mourn. Just a moment. Instinct kicked in and my head peeked up. A rabbit who'd heard the snapping twig. There's that knowing that exists so deep within us in moments like that. An understanding that runs deeper than any other thought. A feeling of ice in the nape of your neck, of stingers pressing beneath your skin. The penny ready to drop. It was watching me. A warrior's breath in, I found strength in the shoe held close to my breast. And I spun around, casting my light behind me to reveal the creature to me. The thing that had murdered my dear brother. It sprinted forth from the darkness like a leopard born of the shadows. A naked figure with skin like white bark, a faceless head, and white, gnarled antlers. I outran my scream as I fled down the cave path. Arms pumping, legs thundering. I flew like the wind itself into the dark. I felt that at any moment my feet would fail me, that my legs would slip out from beneath me, that would be it. I'd be done. The creature that I knew was this Birchwood Jack, which pounced upon me and rend my bleeding flesh from my quivering bones. I refused. If not for me, then for Sammy. I refuse to give this thing the satisfaction. I refuse to let Sammy's memory die down here with me. I refuse to give my parents another heartbreak. God, my parents. It seemed fitting that only in deadly pursuit did I finally have the perspective to realize just how selfish and stupid I'd been. I prayed then, but not to God. I prayed to them, to Mom, to Dad. Prayed that they would hear me, that they would understand, that they'd be okay. And a part of me prayed, like the child that I was, that they would save me. Then the path hit a dead end, and I knew that no one and nothing would save me. I turned, pulling that flare gun from my pants, my only possible weapon, with my back to the wall, and I took deadly aim. The creature, emaciated and gangly, everything I believed Birchwood Jack not to be, turned down the way, and it reached for me, its arms outstretched. Right as I decided to fire, something unexpected happened. The creature's head and limbs snapped forward with a shocking velocity, but its body fell still. It was like the monster had run headlong into an invisible pole. It stopped, but its limbs flailed forward and its head leaned down. Its legs pushed against the slippery ground, trying harder and harder to push itself forward. It reminded me of cattle herders back in Texas, lassoing an angry steer and holding them tight. It wouldn't budge, no matter how much it silently protested. It made the grossest sounds as its rigid skin twisted and bent, like each limb was a fleshy glow stick as its razor claws raked the air. Stunned, I wasn't sure what to do. I had no idea what had happened or what had caused the creature to cease. All I could think or feel was that swelling of adrenaline, the sting of acid in my legs, and a great primal rage building in my throat. I unleashed it, every ounce of hatred that I had felt for this thing. It couldn't reach me and I couldn't hurt it, but I'd damn well show it that I was no scared child. A roar escaped my throat that night that I could never do again. I made a sound so beastly in those caves that I think the ground might have shaken. Every quaking ounce of energy I had left, I felt pour right through my mouth and into the air. Defiance was all I had left, and it felt so good. Granted, it didn't do much else. I was still trapped in a dead end, and this thing blocked my only escape. As I shined my light past it, seeing if perhaps there was enough space for me to slip past and make a break for it, I made an unexpected discovery. Past the creature, something hung in the midst of the tunnel, suspended there in midair, and snaking back along the way we had come. It was long, round, and thick as a python's body. This mass grew out of the back of the beast like a vine, or more aptly, a branch. And it wrapped out of sight around the corner, bending and flexing in weird places like a multi-jointed camera arm. I truly had no idea what to make of it. This creature had quickly gone from something real to something truly bizarre and unknowable. What was that sticking out of its back? As if to make itself even stranger, the beast ceased its flailing. The creature's limbs seemed to go inert, hanging at its sides like that of a simple hanging puppet. It clicked in, then. That's exactly what it was. This creature, literally at the end of its rope, was just some puppeted toy, and the long, still writhing appendage behind it, somewhere at the end of that was where the real monster lay. The real Birchwood Jack. It's an understanding I would come to affirm again and again over the years, and if I had any capability to reflect upon the event with any sort of reverence or pride, it would be in how quickly I saw that facade fade away. Yet, I can't even bring myself to feel any sort of way about it, past dreadful fury. I feel I've relived this day in my head and in my nightmares so many times that sometimes I feel like I'm still down there, trapped between this unspeakable nightmare and a solid wall of stone. Regardless, no revelation was going to fix the problem still before me. This thing had me cornered, and I knew that. That's why its struggling had ceased. It didn't need to strain itself to get me. It could wait. I could not. Sooner or later, I would have to try and get past it. And then what? It would turn and grab me? The chase would continue? Would that giant, twisting construct, as thick as a tree trunk, coil around me, carry me into the unknowing dark? Each option was as terrible as the last. I needed to think and act fast. But the answer was there, staring me right in the face. Antlers adorned his faceless smile. This beast, this inhuman effigy, puppet of the great and unknowable evil beneath the town, was nothing more than the paw of the cat reaching blindly into a mouse hole. It had no face, it had no eyes. Maybe it could hear me, maybe it could smell me, and it could almost certainly feel me. That meant all I had to do was make it think that it had grabbed me. I carefully stripped off the windbreaker jacket that my mom had given me, and I, making sure that my footsteps were clear, took three cautiously placed steps forward. As I expected, the thing reacted, shifting closer to the right side of the cave where I had angled my steps. Its arms slowly raised outwards, thoughtlessly, somewhere between a shooting guard ready to block the three and a zombie coveting my supple brain. Once it was close enough, I took my jacket and made my move. Hand on one sleeve, I cast the other sleeve out, aiming to have the sleeve just gently graze the creature's arm. A silent invitation. Take me, I'm here. Can't you feel me? I'm all yours. The moment that polyester brushed the rigid creature, bark-like skin, it lunged, snapping the sleeve up tight. Bait taken, hook set. I released the jacket. It happened instantly. The creature held firm, its fingers wrapped around the jacket like the teeth of a Venus flytrap, while every other aspect of it seemed to go, once more, inert. The massive line, or dishet, or vine, beyond it grew taut as it reeled in the catch. The effigy jerked backward, its legs and head flopping lifelessly as it was yanked back into the dark. I wanted to feel relaxed, I wanted to feel relief. Some deeper part of me refused to believe it, though. It was too good to be true. It was some sort of ruse, surely. Some sort of trap. Somewhere out there, ready to spring, the beast waited for me to leave the safety of my hole. Somewhere out there, it still prowled. I wish I could have stayed there forever, the image of that thing suddenly bursting back into existence, keeping my legs locked. But I knew that if anything, inaction would mean death. I'd given myself the window I needed. If I waited any longer, if I wasted too much time, then it would find me again. After all, it probably knew right where it had left me. I also realized, as I took stock of myself, my flashlight and my gun, I had left behind Sammy's shoe. In my terror, I had dropped it somewhere along the way. I had left it behind, my only evidence of what had happened, and it was gone. I wanted to go back for it, I really did. But in that cave, I think that letting go hadn't been an accident. Sammy was no longer missing. Not to me. I had my answer. Enough of it, anyways. Sammy was gone. No shoe was going to bring him back. I remembered my parents, and I realized that although it was premature, if I stood any chance of seeing tomorrow, I had to let Sammy go. I didn't go back for it. I had to find the way out. Anger drove the fire back into my legs as I sprinted through that tunnel. I rounded a corner and found something that gave me hope. Something new. I'd stumbled my way into a tunnel system that felt so unlike anything else I'd seen. The cave really opened up here, and the smooth walls gave way to what I recognized as much more natural cave formations. Walls here had visible and protruding layers of rock, eroded by the ages, not by monstrous claws. It was the section of the cave that had been part of the original system beneath Waterbury. That meant I was close to the center. Maybe there I would find the way out. I wasn't prepared for when the cave opened out into this enormous sprawling expanse. I nearly took one step too many. I had to almost throw myself backward when I realized I was standing at the edge of a precipice that dropped down so far that my flashlight couldn't penetrate the gloom. My luck was no better across, either. The flashlight I had was no pushover, but trying to see across that cavern was like trying to shine a flashlight straight up into a dark and cloudy sky. I had no ability to judge the distance, and no ability to get perspective on where I was. Worse than that, I realized I could hear sounds coming from all around me. They sounded like that puppet thing had, with these achy, creaky bursts. They were almost like the sounds of a roaring fire in the summer, snapping and popping in the heat. Maybe I'd followed it all subconsciously. Maybe those noises had lured me here, with intent to the heart of the cave, which made me hesitate. If I was at the heart, then what else was too? What was making those noises? I had a way to find out. A flare gun, single shot. Holding it out, I pointed it up and out over the great expanse. Hesitation gripped me. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do this. I wasn't sure if it was smart to throw away my single and only defense. I could have backtracked, searched down that labyrinth that nearly claimed me before. It was a chance. It was a risk. It wasn't a risk I decided that I wanted to take without options. I pulled the trigger. The air hissed and sizzled as the flare launched into the dark. It soared up and up, higher and further, and as it soared, it brought light into this place that surely had not seen such a thing in so, so long. And as it soared, it painted an ephemeral and grim picture of what lay before me. The cavern was circular and massive, larger than any arena stadium I'd ever been in. Along its perimeter stretched a pathway of sorts, carved and etched into the stone, much like the tunnels I'd stumbled along, and this pathway led into a system of tunnels just like the one I'd come out of. Only there were dozens of them, maybe hundreds. They must have stretched in every direction, north, south, east, and west. If that cave truly was set beneath the heart of Waterbury, then I truly believe that there was not a single stretch of that town that those tunnels couldn't reach. They fed through the soil like roots or a giant ant colony. And ants were there. I saw more of those puppet creatures wandering about, milling around the tunnels and paths. Some ambled aimlessly, while others carried large piles of dirt and rock between their arms. All of them looked shockingly similar. The same emaciated build, the same gnarled antlers atop their head, and the same strange appendage snaking around behind their backs. Here in the open, though, I was able to follow the strange tendrils. My eyes wound and danced, and following the cords that grew thicker and thicker, I traced them back to their source, and I need you to understand that what I saw, I only saw for a few seconds. And yet, it is an image I will never be able to forget. No matter how much I want to. Not every day do you see something so far beyond your understanding. Do you start to believe that your sanity is not something guaranteed, but something transient? Something with a limit. Something that you very much can lose and never recover. Those winding cords led back to a creature so large that it defied all logical explanation. It rose in the center of the expanse like a mound of living, putrid flesh. Those creatures all wound up to these two growths that emerged from the creature's chest. And I noticed 10, maybe 20 in total. In years passing, I've come to realize that those must have been the vestigial remnants of that monster's hands, and every single ambulatory creature existed at the end of its winding, devilish fingers. And then there was its peak, stretching out from some point above what must have been the shoulders of this pyramid of flesh, sat two massive crocodilian jaws. They angled out at almost 180 degrees, with teeth pointing up toward the cavern ceiling like some sort of massive bear trap. I had thoughts of Atlas holding the world, except with much more horrid implications. More than that, in the spaces where the teeth burrowed into the bedrock above, I noticed the hints of a complex and intertwined vascular network between this creature and roots dangling down of trees above. I think it linked itself into the land in there, as well as in other places, too. Behind its back were these fleshy tendrils hung off the cavern walls like tropical forest vines. And there, sitting snug at the center of that twisted maw, a single lump of pale, sun-starved flesh, with what I initially had mistakenly assumed were two festering spots of rot, each the size of a house. They looked to me like the eyes of a potato, or the knots in a bad piece of lumber. Except they weren't knots at all. They were eyes. Great giant eyes. No longer did they even hint at being the man that once had called himself Jack. They towered there above a wide slit that could have swallowed a city block. That I knew was the creature's true mouth because it angled upward into a toothless grin. A grin, I think, that had been meant for me. The flare hit the ceiling and it extinguished. The last thing I saw as the light died was a path to the right of me, so tantalizingly close, where green foliage had spilled inside. I knew instantly that was my way out. The dark returned, and the thing that the townspeople called Birchwood Jack let out a low, earth-trembling groan as it started to reach for me. Those creatures at the tips of its fingers started to move, dashing at me in one communal motion like a pack of hungry wolves. What happened next felt like a blur. I fumbled my way through the darkness as behind me came that sickening crackling and popping as every single one of Birchwood Jack's fingertips reached out and started to gain on me. I saw what I thought was the opening. It was very narrow and very small. I had no idea if the light I saw there was real or hallucination, caused by the rushing blood thrumming in my head. Those things were gaining, though, and I had no other choice. And, of course, right before I reached the exit, I naturally fumbled a flashlight. I made that last 100-yard crawl to freedom in pitch darkness. I felt their clawed hands scratching at my shoes the entire way. Eventually, I flung myself into the air like I'd been birthed from the land. I rolled down a foliage-covered hill, hitting trees and tumbling over rocks on the way down. I came to rest down low at the foot of a smoothly tumbling brook, and I lay there, exhausted, bruised, beaten. I couldn't have moved if I wanted to. I think all my strength had left me. The sounds of the forest were so calm, so beautiful. I'd never been more happy to be in the middle of something I'd hated so much. From the ground, I let my gaze fall up the hill I'd fallen down. There at the precipice, a single figure stood, bathed in the silver moonlight. A gaunt creature of bark and hate, antlers framing its face. Then, a voice. What the hell? I turned. A cop. The same cop from earlier. I was in the woods just beyond the park. I tried to speak, my mouth full of dirt and blood, pointing up to the hill where the creature had already vanished. Not that it would have mattered. because the cop knelt down beside me, removed his hat, and brushed back his sweaty hair. He shook his head disapprovingly. "You dumb kid." He took me home that night without saying another word. He helped me into my house. My parents were already home and worried sick. He explained my story for me, saying that I'd been in the woods looking for my brother and that I'd taken a nasty spill. I used to wonder why he did that, why he never said anything else to me. But like so much in life, I think time really makes everything so clear. The nights belonged to Jack, after all. We didn't stay in Waterbury long after Sammy. Within 4 months, the search had been called off, and my parents had decided that what was best for everyone was to move on and to heal. I'd made a point to go back into the basement the first moment I could. I was surprised to find that the concrete slab had already been replaced, and the red-leaved sapling had vanished, but it wasn't quite enough. I moved every single box in the basement atop that spot. All of the heaviest things we owned, every box, every bin, every useless dumbbell. I left the basement that day and I never went back. At night, I barricaded my own bedroom door. The week we left, I made it a point to go around and tear down every last poster still remaining with Sammy's face. It felt like the town had turned on us that night and we were no longer welcome in their little piece of paradise. I wanted no piece of Sammy to remain there when we were gone. They didn't deserve him. They never deserved him. I thought about that pretty little town as I made my way back to the park and all the luck they had. I thought about what I saw above, and I thought about the beast below, the one they built it all atop of, the one that fed into the land and from the land. I thought about how, with such a hollow expanse beneath the town, should have fallen into hell years ago. Then I remembered the massive maw of Birchwood Jack and how it held against the roof of the cavern, and I realized that was it. He was holding it all up, a parasite in the land. It made me sick. And that brought me back to the weird, lonely tree, the last picture left of Sammy I needed to take down. I pulled those staples out one by one, and I held the flyer close. I would never have enough of Sammy to remember him by, to hold and think of him. So on that freezing day, I held that flyer to my heart and hugged it tight. As I did, the tree started to bleed. It was a curious sight, but not the strangest I'd seen, nor the most unexpected. You see, I had my hunches for a while, and I thought that maybe, just maybe, that would be the case. Maybe, just maybe, one or more of those teeth that held this town up were poking through the dirt. The teeth, running with blood of the innocent, used to sustain that creature, and maybe sustain this land. I had no idea what kind of symbiosis they shared, nor did I care. All I knew was that I had brought an axe. The first swing carved the bark, the second swing scored flesh. I wasn't ready for the splash of blood that shot out like a syrup from a maple tree on my third swing, but I didn't flinch and I didn't stop. I think it was by the eighth or ninth swing that I started to feel it, the tremors down below. I wondered if it would feel it. I certainly hoped. The moment it confirmed it, the most gleefully smile spread across my face. I started to slow down my strikes. No need to rush it, was there? I had the time. All day I chopped at that tree, over and over, only breaking when folks wandered into the park, hoping they wouldn't notice the fresh blood coagulating on the mercifully snowless ground. All day I chopped, and slowly, those tremors grew into screams. I heard, as I'm sure the whole town did, that wretched, evil, hateful thing screaming as I dug that axe in time and time again. I twisted and I pulled and I wrenched that axe free, only to bring it back once more. I worked my way around the entire base, taking more than my fair share of utterly unnecessary swings. I imagined the pain of something hacking away at my own tooth. Imagined every single sensitive nerve ending, every single ounce of agony. I started to laugh. It was the first time in 4 months. I'd wondered if it would reach out for me. I occasionally glanced to the woods to see if I would catch one of them lurking, ready to pounce, but it was a bright and beautiful day, and I knew that the coward never would. It could never face the day. When it finally fell, hanging on only by a few final threads, I took my pocket knife to work carefully, sawing those final nervous sinews. When they were finally severed, the beast quaked so loud that the USGS registered a 2.7 magnitude earthquake coming out of Waterbury that night. I had my fun. I undid my zipper and I urinated and spit on the stump, desperate for some other way to defile and debase the creature that had taken everything from me. When I was done, and after I had screamed and kicked, stomped and slashed, and finally after I buried my axe firmly in that still oozing, fleshy nub, I leaned in and whispered to the dirt and the devil beneath, "We will never be even, but I think that's a good start, don't you?" There was no response, and within 24 hours, I turned my back on Waterbury, New Hampshire. I have never been back, nor do I have any desire to. Sometimes I imagine turning on the news to find that the whole town mysteriously vanished overnight. I imagine news of a tragic cave-in. I imagine the day that I'm sure will come when the hunger beneath them finally decides to take that final big bite. I watched in the rearview mirror as the welcome sign faded into the distance. "Welcome to Waterbury, New Hampshire," it read. "Home of the American Dream." I hope you enjoyed Birchwood Jack by Carol Ann Brenneman, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Carol-Ann-Brenneman. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Carol-Ann-Brenneman. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. They say some legends grow with time, but I think this may be a bit of a stretch for most. Sometimes, though, we don't go looking for trouble, but it certainly comes looking for us. Take the tale of two campers, courtesy of Warren Benedetto, who were out for one last fling before settling down in a more familiar way, and are about to find out that there are things much worse than having a bear eat your last granola bar. Without further ado, I present to you Baby Food. That was my idea of the camping trip. I had so many great memories of camping over the years, with my family, with the Boy Scouts, with my college buddies. We'd find some remote spot in the woods, then spend a week just doing nothing. I wanted Liz to experience that, to get her to unplug from everything for once. Her phone, her email, her social media accounts. To just stop and live. Liz didn't want to go, of course. She wanted to jaunt off to some exotic location, seizing the last chance to travel together before we embarked on our next great adventure, parenthood. A baby moon, she called it. She envisioned a romantic getaway to Cabo or Paris or Tuscany or any Instagram-friendly destination that would stroke her followers' envy. Something that didn't involve sleeping in a tent and fighting off mosquitoes or bears. There are no bears, I insisted over dinner at Manuel's.
our favorite Mexican hotspot downtown. I took another sip of my margarita. Probably, I added, as I scooped up a generous portion of salsa with an oversized tortilla chip and popped it into my mouth. Probably? One or two beers, tops. Listen, I'm a simple girl, Liz said. She reached out and took my hands in her own. I like the simple things in life. Running water, a toilet, walls. Walls are overrated. We need walls, dear, because that's where they put doors. She explained patiently, and we need doors because that's how we get room service. I'll make you a deal. You spend one night camping with me, and if you don't have the best time of your life, I'll book a trip to Cabo the second we get home. If we get home, she corrected. One night, I squeezed her hands. It'll be fun, I promise. What do you think? I said, making a sweeping gesture with my arm. We were in a clearing in the woods overlooking a shimmering sapphire blue lake. Majestic pines soared skyward, forming a cathedral-like canopy overhead. Golden sunlight streamed through the trees. Beautiful, right? Liz unslung her backpack and let it fall to the ground. Let's just get this over with. That's the spirit, I cheered. You aren't need a help with the tent, or... I trailed off. The look on her face made it clear that no, she did not want to help me with the tent. All right, just me then, as I busied myself unpacking the tent. Liz wandered over to the edge of the campsite and looked out across the water. A nice view, at least, she conceded. Wish I could post a picture. Oh, no, wait. She patted her shorts as if checking her pockets. I don't have my phone. She looked over her shoulder at me with a pointed glare. I gave her a maniacal laugh, then unrolled the tent and began staking it to the ground with a rubber mallet, talking as I worked. You know, I used to come up here with my dad when I was a kid to this exact spot. I finished with the stakes on one corner of the tent, then moved over to the other. I ever tell you about the time my brother and I went skinny dipping in the lake? Not the smartest idea. It was freezing. Talk about shrinkage. I didn't see my nuts for a week. I looked up over my shoulder to gauge Liz's response. She wasn't there. Liz, I called. Babe? I straightened up and looked around the clearing. Her bag was still where she'd dropped it, but she was nowhere in sight. I stood and dusted off my knees. Liz, I called again, a little louder this time. The bears get you already? I walked over to where she had just been standing. Her boot prints terminated at the edge of a steep drop-off. What the hell? I mumbled to myself. I cupped my hands around my mouth and shouted, Liz! My voice echoed across the lake and back. For a few seconds, there was no reply. Then a small voice responded. Down here! I stepped closer to the edge of the drop-off. There was a narrow footpath through the undergrowth that wound its way down the steep cliffside. I started heading along the path towards her voice. Where'd you go? I shouted. I found something, she yelled back. Come check this out. On my way. The path snaked dangerously along the rim of the drop-off, its crumbling edge just inches from a nasty 50-foot tumble to the water below. As I made my way down the steep incline, I skidded a bit in the loose sandy earth. Planted my arm against the wall of the cliff to brace myself, then drew it away with a disgusted grimace. The rock was coated in a black, tar-like substance. I smeared it along my forearm from my wrist to my elbow. Damn it, I grumbled. You okay? Liz called. Her voice was closer now, just out of sight. Yeah, I just put my arm in some, I don't know, something. I tried to wipe it off my shirt, but it clung to my skin with glue-like stubbornness. The stuff was sticky. incredibly, insanely sticky. As I rounded the corner, I found Liz squatting on the ground in a small cave scooped out from the side of the cliff. It was wide and shallow, about the size of a large bedroom, with a narrow passageway in the back that seemed to lead deeper into the bedrock. The floor was lined with heavy green moss, kept moist by a steady drip of water trickling down from the rock overhang above. Vines thick with magenta flowers hung down over the opening like a beaded curtain. "Oh, wow," I said, marveling at the sight. "I had no idea this was here." Liz stood and turned around to face me. A blue plastic water bottle was in her hand. She held it out to me. Her face looked worried. "Look at this." I took the bottle. It was nothing special, just your ordinary standard-issue 32-ounce water bottle. Crystal blue, pretty new-looking. A sip of water left inside. "What about it?" "Turn it over." I rotated the bottle in my hand, and I saw what she was talking about. "You just found this?" She nodded. "Where do you think it came from?" I looked around the area where we stood. There was no sign of trouble, no other indication that anyone had been there. But obviously someone had been. Something must have happened. And whatever it was, it couldn't have been good. Scratched into the side of the water bottle were two words, just six letters, in all caps. "Help me." I peered deeper into the cave. The light dropped off precipitously a few feet past the entrance, shrouding the depths in a heavy veil of shadow. I felt a flutter in my stomach at the idea of treading farther into the darkness without at least a flashlight. There really could be a bear back there. It was unlikely, but it wasn't impossible. "We need to call someone," Liz said. "How?" "We left our phones in the car." "Well, we need to go get them." I suppressed a mild ripple of an annoyance. She was really determined to get her phone, wasn't she? She couldn't even be away from it for a day without going through withdrawal. "It's like a 4-hour hike," I said. "Even if we did, what would we say?" I held up the water bottle. "We don't even know what this is." "It's literally a cry for help, Kev." "Yeah, but from who? And from when? For all we know, it's been down here for months, maybe years." "You act like it's perfectly normal to find something like that." "It's not normal, but it's not like an emergency, right? There's nobody bleeding out or anything." "That we know of," Liz corrected. I motioned around the cave. "Do you see anyone?"
"No."
"Hear anyone?"
"No."
"Okay, then." I put my arms around her and kissed the top of her head. "Everything's fine. We'll stop by the ranger station on our way out of the park in the morning, all right?" Liz shrugged. "I guess." "This place is pretty cool, though, right?" I asked, trying to change the subject. I reached out and cupped one of the flowers in my hand. "Beautiful. We should come down here and have a picnic tomorrow." "What's in the walls?" I walked over and examined the side of the cave. It was covered with the same stuff I'd stumbled into outside. No idea, some kind of tar, maybe. It's sticky as hell. "Ew, you touched it?" "On the way down, yeah, by accident. I held up my arm. It was still smeared with the unidentified goo." "Ugh, gross." I stepped closer to the wall. There was something stuck in the tar. I furrowed my brow and reached for it. "Can you not?" Liz asked, a hint of impatience in her voice. "Let's go back up." I turned around and nodded. "Yeah, okay, let's go." As I followed Liz out of the cave, I looked down at what I had pulled from the tar. It was a tangle of long brown hair, human hair. Without a word, I opened my fingers and let it drift away on the wind. I followed Liz, single file, up the path toward the campsite. When she reached the top, she stopped in her tracks. I nearly collided with her back. "Whoa, you okay?" "Where's our stuff?" I looked past Liz and into the campsite. Sure enough, all of our possessions were gone. Our tent, our backpacks, everything. I turned around and looked down the trail, thinking maybe we'd accidentally come up a different way and ended up in the wrong spot. There didn't seem to be any other path. In fact, I could still see the skid marks in the dirt from where I had slipped on my way down. I stepped around Liz and wandered over to where I'd started setting up the tent. Even the tent stakes were missing. The mallet, too. "Huh," I said. I put my hands on my hips. "That's weird." "Weird?" Liz exclaimed. "Kevin, what the hell?" "I don't know," I said. "I'm thinking." I walked slowly around the campsite, examining the ground. There were no tracks, no footprints. It was as if everything had just vanished. "What are we going to do?" Liz asked. Her voice was on the verge of panic. "I said I'm thinking," I snapped. Liz recoiled as if slapped. I exhaled, trying to regain my patience. "I'm sorry, I just... give me a minute, okay? I told you we shouldn't have come." Ignoring Liz's comment, I paced around the campsite. "It must have been an animal," I mumbled to myself, "but why would it take the tent?"
"If it was a bear..."
I shot Liz a look. "Stop. What else is big enough to steal our bags? A squirrel?" "It wasn't a bear."
"Then what?"
"I don't know. A person?" Liz went pale. She lowered her voice to a near whisper.
"You think someone followed us?"
I silently cursed myself for introducing the possibility.
"No, no, of course not."
"Then why did you say that?" "I was just..." I shook my head. "It's not a person." She didn't look convinced. "Look." I walked over to where we'd first entered the campsite. "This is us." I pointed at two pairs of footprints heading into the campsite. "Nobody else came in. And nobody went out, okay?" My explanation seemed to calm Liz down a bit.
"Okay, so what was it then?"
I didn't answer. I continued to circle the perimeter of the campsite. Despite my explanation, I knew that in fact a person was the most likely culprit. A bear would have torn into the backpacks looking for food. That's all it would have cared about. It probably wouldn't have carried away the bags altogether, and it certainly wouldn't have taken the tent, or the spikes, or the mallet. But if it was a person, then who was it? The chances of someone else being out in the same area at the same time were slim to nil. We were in the middle of nowhere, a half day's hike from the nearest trailhead. The path we'd followed was so overgrown from disuse that we'd lost it altogether a few times. Only my memories of landmarks from my family camping trips had gotten us back on track.
"Hey, Kevin,"
Liz called.
"Let's just go home, okay? This sucks."
I looked at the sky. The sun was already dipping low on the horizon. It wasn't quite sunset yet, but there was probably only an hour of daylight left. Maybe less. Even more troubling, a bank of low, dark storm clouds was rolling in over the hills on the other side of the lake. Rain wasn't in the forecast. I'd checked the weather before we left. But apparently something had changed. I shook my head. "We'll never make it back before dark. We have to. We can't. It's too far." "So what are we going to do? Sleep in the dirt?" "It's better than getting lost in the woods, especially at night, trust me." A slow rumble rolled across the water. Lightning flashed in the distance. Liz threw up her hands. "And it's going to rain. Awesome." "Let's not panic."
"I'm not panicking," Liz snapped. "I'm pissed. I knew this would happen."
"Oh, right," I said. My tone was barbed. "Because it never rains in Cabo."
"Forget the rain. Where's our stuff, Kevin? We've got no tent, no food."
"We'll live. It's just one night. And I've got snacks." I patted the day pack I'd slung across my chest. Oh, you've got snacks, Liz repeated, unimpressed. You owe me big time. Fine, we'll go to Cabo, okay? Is that what you want? Let's go. Right now. Screw Cabo. After this, we're going to Paris. You know what? I seethed. I walked to the edge of the campsite and looked out over the lake. Sheets of rain were already falling at the far end. Another crack of thunder echoed through the hills. A strong gust of wind blew across the water and rattled the trees. I began walking down the footpath toward the cave. I called to Liz without looking back. You coming? Wow, look at that, I said, my voice full of awe. The approaching storm was dropping a near-perfect wall of rain halfway across the lake, obscuring the landscape behind a great gray veil of mist. Lightning flashed in the clouds, turning them from an ominous gunmetal gray to a brilliant purple-white. How often do you get to watch a storm roll in like that? Liz ignored my enthusiasm. She drew her knees up to her chest and shivered.
Freezing.
I deflated. Clearly, Liz didn't share my fascination with extreme weather. She wasn't wrong, though. It was getting cold. And it would only get colder once the sun went down. We needed to build a fire if we wanted to stay warm. I untied my hoodie from around my waist and draped it over Liz's shoulders.
Here. Thanks.
She pulled her arms into the hoodie, watching as I stood and dusted off the back of my pants.
Where are you going?
I'm going to go find some firewood.
Leaving me alone?
I'll be right up there. I pointed up the trail we'd just descended. If you need anything, just yell. I'll hear you.
Great,
Liz quipped. I'll be sure to scream extra loud while I'm getting murdered.
All right, then come with me if you want.
Liz pulled the hoodie tighter around her shoulders and stared at her shoes.
No, it's fine. Just go.
I waited at the entrance of the cave, tapping my foot. I sighed impatiently. I wasn't going to take the bait. I knew that if I left, I'd catch hell for abandoning her. Of course, if I'd stayed, I'd catch hell for letting us freeze to death. Either way, I was screwed. After a long minute of loaded silence, Liz looked up at me.
Well, are you going?
I threw up my hands in exasperation, then began trudging up the slope to the campsite. It wasn't my fault the trip had turned into a disaster. She'd never let me live it down, though. I'd be paying penance through budget-busting trips to Europe for the next decade. Actually, that wasn't true, was it? We wouldn't be going anywhere for quite a while if Liz got her way. I'd seen her Pinterest boards and the way they'd gone from aesthetic stagings of succulents and fairy lights to photo shoots of nurseries and crib sets. I noticed how our weekends with friends had morphed from cake stands and body shots to gender reveals and baby showers. Liz had even started turning down glasses of wine with demure deferrals like, I really shouldn't. It was ridiculous. She wasn't even pregnant. At least I didn't think she was. If she was, well, I wasn't sure what I'd do. I wasn't ready to be a father, that's for sure. Maybe I was just being selfish, but I wanted to keep her to myself for a while before relinquishing her to a suckling, screaming, needy baby that would drain every ounce of her energy and time. I wasn't ready to let her go just yet. As I plodded into the dense forest, something crunched under my foot. It wasn't a natural-sounding crunch like a broken branch or a dead leaf. It sounded more like the crunch of a plastic cup, like the kind that my brother and I had used in our summer lemonade stands when we were kids. I looked down to find myself standing on the shattered exoskeleton of some giant insect. No, not just giant, enormous. Judging by the legs poking out of the thing, it had been the size of a large dog. I stepped backward off the crushed remains, then squatted down and picked up one of the jointed limbs. The appendage was bigger than the biggest king crab leg I'd ever seen. It was almost as long as my arm. I flexed the leg in my hands.
I couldn't even imagine what kind of insect it might have come from. A giant grasshopper, maybe? I'd seen some pretty terrifying pictures on the internet. Nightmare fuel like camel spiders in Iraq, or whatever hellspawn Australia birthed from the bush. But I'd never seen anything so hideous in my part of the world, until now. Whatever kind of insect it was, it appeared to be growing. The leg was hollow and brittle, just the chitinous remains of a molted exoskeleton. I shuddered to think how much bigger the thing might have gotten since it had shed its shell. I wasn't afraid of bugs. I had no problem with the occasional house spider or cricket or whatever. But I wasn't keen to meet the H.R. Geiger reject that leg had come from. It looked like something from the set of Alien. As I flung the leg into the woods, I caught a glimpse of a bright yellow object nearby. I moved closer to get a better look. Sticking up from a pile of leaves was the handle of a mallet. My mallet. The one I'd been using to pound tent spikes just a few minutes before. I turned in a slow circle and looked around me. There was no sign of anyone or anything else nearby. But the giant pine tree behind me was completely coated in the same strange black substance as in the cave, rippling with solidified waves of hardened resin. My eyes crawled up the trunk, searching for the source of the effluence. I gasped. I could feel the blood drain from my face. Slung in a hammock, like web, high overhead was our camping gear. The web appeared to be spun from filaments of the same tar-like resin that covered the tree. It formed an intricate lattice that bridged from branch to branch and tree to tree, extending as far into the woods as I could see. At various places in the web, suspended high above the ground, were thick, bulging, cocoon-like structures. A fleshless rib cage was visible in one of them. From another protruded the rotting remains of a wide appendage with thick yellow-brown claws. A bear paw. I started backing slowly away from the scene. I don't know what had dragged our gear into the trees or why, but I knew one thing. We weren't safe there. Anything that could capture and kill a bear that size would have no problem doing the same to us. I couldn't tell Liz that, though. She'd insist that we flee immediately, and there was no way we could do that. Getting lost in the woods at night during a thunderstorm was no less dangerous than whatever was in those trees. No, we would need to spend the night. We'd huddle up in the cave, build a fire, and get a good night's rest. Then, as soon as the sun came up, we'd get out of there. That should do it. I dumped an armful of logs onto the floor of the cave, then wiped the dust and sweat from my forehead with the front of my shirt. Everything all right up there? Liz asked. Yeah, why? I replied, busying myself with rearranging the wood into a neat stack to avoid having her see my worried expression. It took a while, that's all. She rubbed her hands over her arms to warm herself. How long until you get a fire going? A crack of thunder split the sky as if officially signaling that the storm had arrived. Rain began to patter on the ground outside. A spray of cold mist blew into the cave. Not long, I replied, but we should move further in. Liz eyed the narrow, dark passage that led to the deeper reaches of the cave. She looked at me skeptically. You think that's a good idea? I gestured with a sweep of my arm. Ladies first. Well, no, after you. I shrugged, then slid sideways into the passage. It was a tight fit. I could feel the heat of my breath reflecting off the rocks as I sidestepped through the gap. The truth was, the fire probably would have been fine in the outer part of the cave, but I wanted to get as far away as possible from whatever had dragged our stuff and those animals into the tree. If the thing was big enough to kill a bear, it was probably too big to fit through such a narrow gap in the cave wall. We'd be safer in there, I was sure of it. I was wrong. I emerged from the gap into an expansive cavern several times larger than the one on the other side. In the fading light, I could just about make out the curve of the cavern's far wall. It arched high overhead, disappearing into the inky black darkness. Unfortunately, the smell of the tar was worse in there, probably from the lack of air circulation. Still, it was the best we could do under the circumstances. It was either deal with the smell or deal with whatever the hell was out there in the woods. I preferred the former. I called back to Liz. Come on through, it's fine. Liz's voice filtered in from the outside. No bears? No bears. A moment later, Liz slipped tentatively into the cavern. She waved her arms in front of her face as if to ward off any stray spiderwebs that might be in her way. Her nose wrinkled. Oh, it stinks. Yeah, I know, I'm sorry, but hey. I slapped my palm on the side of the cavern. You wanted walls. We've got walls. Great, she deadpanned. After retrieving the firewood, I knelt in the center of the cavern and began piling logs into a pyramid, stuffing the gaps underneath with handfuls of kindling. Then I unzipped my day pack, pulled up my Zippo lighter, sparked a flame, and touched it to the kindling. Oh, look at you, you're such a man, Liz teased. In a cave, making fire. She smiled fondly as she watched me adjust the logs to better catch the growing flames. The blaze grew stronger, looking upward. The shadows in the cave began to retreat from the light. The warmth chased the chill out of the air. The comforting smell of wood smoke replaced the stink of the tar. I poked the logs with a thick branch, then sat back on my heels. I nodded to myself, satisfied, then glanced at Liz. She was still grinning at me. What? I asked. To infinity. Liz and I first met during the screening of Toy Story during freshman year orientation. Buzz Lightyear's catchphrase had become our secret way of saying, I love you. And beyond, I replied. You're a good guy, she said, lacing her fingers through mine. I know you're trying your best, I laughed. You just sound like my little league coach. Liz squeezed my hand. Stop, that's not what I mean. I know, I'm sorry. This obviously isn't going as planned. It's okay, it's just one night, right? She leaned in for a kiss. I gave her a peck on the lips. Right. She kept her face close to mine. So now what? Before I could respond, she kissed me again, longer this time. Her body moved closer to mine, her breast pressing against my arm. I reluctantly returned her affection. I wasn't exactly in the mood to hook up under the circumstances. I just wanted to make it through the night without running into that thing from the woods. But Liz knew my weak spot. She started nibbling on my neck. She darted her tongue into my ear, sending goosebumps racing down my arms. Her lips brushed against my earlobe. I stopped taking my pills, she whispered. I drew away from her and looked at her face. Really? Mm-hmm. She leaned in to kiss me again. Suddenly, I dodged backward and swiped at my face. Oh, what the hell? Liz sat back, shocked. What? I reached up and touched the front of my hair. My hand came away coated with black, sticky residue. I frowned, then looked up. Liz did the same. She screamed, backpedaling across the cave floor. Jesus, I gasped as I scrambled to a spot nearby. 10 feet overhead, a woman's body was hanging face down from the ceiling. She was partially enmeshed in the same sort of cocoon I'd seen in the woods. Thick black bands of the stuff stretched upward from the sides, disappearing from the shadows above. The woman seemed to be dead. Her head hung limp and loose on her neck. Long brown hair dangled over her face, obscuring it from view. Her abdomen was ruptured. A sagging, fleshy black sac swelled from the wound like a horrifying tumor. It glistened in the firelight, its gelatinous-looking surface rippling and rolling with the movement of whatever was contained within. The
Elastic drops of melting black goo dripped from the sack and hissed into the fire. The smell was unbearable.
"What is that?"
Liz whispered. Her voice trembled with fear. I didn't answer. My mind was trying to place what I was seeing in some sort of context I could understand, but I had no frame of reference for something so abominable. If it was just the one woman on the ceiling, it would have been bad enough, but it wasn't just her. The entire roof of the cave was hung with desiccated corpses in various states of decay, each entombed in a cocoon-like mesh of black resin, each with an eviscerated torso split open, with the remains of a fleshy black sack spilling out. And like the sack hanging from the first woman's body, the others appeared to be empty. Suddenly, the woman's chin lifted. Her lips parted, revealing teeth slicked with black slime. She seemed to be trying to speak. Long tendrils of ink-black ooze spilled from her lips. After a moment, her eyes gained focus. She turned her head and looked at me. Her lips formed a single word. "Run." Before we could react, the sack in the woman's gut split open, dumping a gush of milky, viscous fluid onto the fire below. The flames were extinguished immediately. The darkness was immediate and absolute. Something heavy and wet-sounding fell to the ground, pushing a gust of hot, fetid air against our faces. I slid closer to Liz. She clutched me tightly, her body shaking.
"Don't move,"
I whispered, and I felt her head nod against my chest. After a few seconds, my eyes began to adjust to the darkness. I could vaguely discern the passage out of the cavern, an irregularly shaped vertical gash only slightly less black than the rest of the cave. It was maybe 20 feet away. To reach it, we'd have to pass under the cocooned woman, under the sack, and past whatever had just birthed out of it. Suddenly, a guttural sound with a clicking undertone vibrated through the cavern. It had a sharp, cold resonance, like a spring being wound inside a metal tube. At the same time, lightning flashed outside, revealing a monstrous silhouette climbing down the wall, backlit against the entrance to the cave. It was an insectile form with a pair of jointed, serrated limbs flexing in front of it, and a long, segmented body that curved up in the back like the tail of a scorpion. Before I could process the sight, the cave was again plunged into total darkness.
"What the hell?"
I said under my breath.
"What? What is it?"
Liz asked. Her voice sounded tiny and muffled in my shirt. I didn't answer. Whatever the thing was, it was bigger than me, way bigger, and it was moving. I could hear its limbs clicking on the stone-cold wall. The sound of marbles in a cloth bag. The noise echoed around the cave, seeming to approach from all directions at once. I drew my legs up closer to my body and bent protectively over Liz, trying to make us both as small as possible. Perspiration trickled down my spine and into the waistband of my underwear. A mixture of sweat and tears slicked my face and dripped from my nose into Liz's head. The clicking sound drew closer, its direction more defined. It seemed to be coming from overhead now. Liz's body tensed. I could feel her heart pounding like a kick drum inside her ribs, thudding in an alternating, irregular rhythm with my own racing pulse. Her breath came in short, whistling gasps. She was hyperventilating. I closed my eyes and cursed silently to myself. It was so stupid. We should have left when Liz found the water bottle with the ominous message. I knew that then, I just didn't want to show her that I was scared. I didn't want to let her be right about the trip, about me. Instead, I kept pressing on, pretending like I had it all under control, like she was the one being unreasonable. But as usual, she was right and I was wrong. The truth was, I didn't know what to do. I was helpless, and that terrified me. Suddenly, Liz was yanked violently from my arms. She disappeared upward into the darkness, a primal scream of mortal terror escaping from her throat
as she was pulled from my grip. She was torn away so quickly with such speed and such force that it took a second for me to process what had just happened. One moment she was there, and the next she had vanished. After a short delay, my adrenaline surged. "Liz!" I yelled. I reached blindly for her in the dark, but my hand found nothing but air. "Liz!" I screamed again. There was no response, just a long, deathly silence. She was gone. Panicked, I scrambled forward on my hands and knees, forgetting about the fire that had been burning in front of me just a few moments before. My hand plunged into the still smoldering embers. With an anguished scream, I jerked my hand backward out of the heat. My elbow collided with something hard and smooth behind me. A guttural clicking noise filled my ears. Then everything went dark. I awakened on the ground sometime later, half blinded by the nauseating pain pulsing from a puncture wound in my shoulder. A stinger the size of a butcher knife was embedded deep in my muscle, held in place by rows of vicious barbs. I tried to pull it out, but pain was excruciating. I looked over to the entrance of the cave. Judging by the narrow sliver of sunlight streaming in from outside, the sting had knocked me out for hours. It was daytime again. I struggled to my feet, completely disoriented about where I was or how I'd gotten there. It was only when I heard Liz's terrified whimpering that it all came back to me, all came back rushing to me. I turned to find her lashed to the wall of the cave, wide bands of sticky black resin crisscrossing her limbs. Her skin was grayish-white, the color of clouds heavy with rain. Damp hair clung to her forehead and cheeks. Her face was sunken as if she'd lost 20 pounds overnight. When Liz saw me stand, her eyes went wide. She became panicked, verging on the edge of total breakdown. She begged me to help her to get her out of there. I tore at the bands with my bare arms, but the stuff was as taut and strong as steel cables. Freeing her was hopeless. I stepped back and looked at her, trying to better assess the situation. Her shirt was torn open down the middle. Just below her ribs, a round, fist-sized hole had been punched through her skin. The flesh around the wound was bruised a deep purple. The hole itself appeared to have been sealed with the same sticky black tar that bound her to the wall. As the realization of what was happening washed over me, Liz spoke. "It's inside of me," she whimpered. My mouth opened, then closed. She was right. I could see something moving under her skin, its segmented body grotesquely distending her flesh as it rolled and twisted. Liz arched her back against the wall and screamed through gritted teeth, her eyes bulging with fear and pain. "Cut it out," she pleaded. "What?" My brain struggled to comprehend what she was asking. Did she seriously want me to? "Please," she gasped. Tears streamed from her red-rimmed eyes and fell to the dirt below. "Cut it out." My head swam as I tried to grapple with the enormity of what she was asking me to do. Cut it out. How could I possibly do that? Even if it worked, even if I could excise the organism growing inside of her, she'd hemorrhage to death before I was able to get help. But if I did nothing, she would end up like the others, her abdomen eventually rupturing from the hideous life form consuming her from within. The thing moved again. The pointed tip of one of its limbs pressed against Liz's skin from inside, like a dull knitting needle straining to break through thick fabric. Liz screamed, louder this time. The sound reverberated through the empty expanse of the cave. It electrified me, finally spurring me into action. "Okay," I said, "hang on." My day pack was still on the floor of the cave where I dropped it the night before when I was making the fire. I tore open the zipper and began digging through the contents of the bag. Granola bars, sunscreen, hand sanitizer, a Zippo lighter, bug spray. An irrational burst of laughter escaped from my lips. Bug spray, I thought.
A lot of good that did us. Finally, I found the only thing that mattered. A knife. It was a small pocket knife. The blade was 3 inches, 4 inches, tops. Good for little more than opening letters and slicing packing tape. It was certainly never intended to do what I needed to do with it now. What I needed was a scalpel in a hospital, and to be a surgeon instead of a business analyst at a consulting firm. And for all of this to be some kind of horrible, fever-driven nightmare instead of the unimaginable reality I was facing. I snapped open the knife and pressed my thumb against the cutting edge. It was even more dull than I remembered. It didn't matter. It was my only option. It would have to do. "Okay, babe," I said as I hurried back to Liz. "I need you to hold still." "I can't," she yelled, spittle flying from her lips. "You have to. I can't do it if you're moving around like this. I'll hurt you." Liz looked me in the eyes, begging. "I can feel it chewing," she said with a terrified whisper. A helpless groan escaped her lips. I swallowed hard but said nothing. Grasping the knife tightly in my trembling hand, I held it against her stomach. "Ready?" She closed her eyes and nodded. I steadied my hand, then pushed the blade into her skin. She screamed through clenched teeth as I sawed downward, opening a wandering 3-inch incision in the middle of her stomach. A mixture of blood and black crude erupted from the wound, splashing over my hands and streaking down Liz's belly to her thighs. Nauseated, I jerked away from the gush and dropped the knife onto the ground. My heart froze in my chest. A thin, jointed limb extended from the wound. It was followed by another, and another, and another. They pressed outward, further tearing the incision. Liz wailed again, tears spilled from her eyes. I watched in numb horror as a head emerged through the gash. It was the size of a baseball, ochre-colored, with dark bulbous eyes and a terrifying maw of gnashing mouthparts. Blood and mucus drooled from its serrated jaws as it chewed around the edges of the wound. Peristaltic waves undulated down its swollen, pus-colored body as it squirmed further out of Liz's stomach, its forelegs groping blindly. It appeared to be some sort of larva. Liz's teeth chattered as waves of shock convulsed her body. She strained to speak through trembling lips. "Kill it!" As the last of the larva's 6 legs squeezed out of Liz's gut, gravity took over. The creature slipped from her body and onto the ground with a wet squelch. It curled and twisted, legs spreading and flexing, then rolled onto its side as it tried to right itself. I couldn't believe the size of the thing. It was as thick and long as my leg, from my knee to my ankle. I had no idea how something so huge could have fit inside my wife's petite frame. I looked around for something to use as a weapon. My eyes fell on the yellow handle of my mallet, the one I'd retrieved from the woods earlier. I bent and picked it up, then dropped to my knees next to the squirming larva, raised the mallet high and slammed it down on the creature's head, caving it in. The larva made a mewling, hissing noise as it writhed in apparent agony. I kept pummeling the thing, hammering it over and over, until it was nothing but a mass of gelatinous remains. Finally, I let the mallet tumble from my hands. My face was dripping with a mixture of blood and gore from both Liz and the larva. My chest and shoulders heaved as I gasped for air. "I got it," I muttered. "Okay, babe, I got it. It's gone." I looked up at my wife. Her body hung limp against the wall, her chin on her chest. "Liz?" I said. She didn't respond. I stood and grabbed her by the shoulders, shaking her. Her head lolled on her neck. "Liz," I said again, louder this time, still no response. I lifted her chin. Her eyes were wide, unseeing. "Oh, no. Come on. Come on, stay with me." I pressed my fingers against her jugular, feeling for a pulse. Nothing. I began thrusting my hands against her heart, trying to pump life back into her body. Blood surged from her wound as I compressed her chest. Her body remained still, unresponsive. It was too late. She was dead. A cry of pure anguish escaped from my lips. I fell forward against her body, pressing my face against hers. I kissed her cheeks, her forehead, her hair, all the time whispering to her, telling her how sorry I was, how I wished I had listened to her, how I should have taken her to Cabo or Paris or anywhere she wanted to go, anywhere but this godforsaken place. How I did want a baby, I really did. I was just afraid of sharing her with someone else, someone who needed her more than I did, who would steal her attention away from me. It was stupid and selfish and immature, and I was sorry, so, so sorry. Eventually, her skin grew cold, her limbs began to stiffen. The blood seeping from her wound slowed, then stopped, congealing into tacky brown puddles on the ground. As my adrenaline faded, the pain from my own injuries came flooding back. Puncture wound in the stinger, impaled in my shoulder, throbbed viciously. Waves of heat radiated down my shoulder to my chest, then to my gut. I was overwhelmed with a rolling, surging nausea, as if my stomach was physically turning over my body. It felt almost as if something was moving inside of me. My breathing hitched to my chest. Oh, God. I stepped away from Liz and turned toward the light from outside the cave. My once white shirt was crusted with drying blood, both Liz's and my own, along with a wide pool of sticky brown tar in the center. Reluctantly, I curled my fingers under the bottom edge of my shirt and lifted it. A helpless, plaintive wail arose in my throat. Under my skin was a grotesque crescent-shaped protrusion as thick and long as my calf muscle. The thing pulsed and flexed, the tips of its pointed legs pressing against the underside of my flesh. I could see the curve of its head, the line of its body, the rippling motion of its mouth parts. I could feel it moving, growing, and chewing. I could feel it chewing. With an empty stare, I fell to my knees, then plunged my head into the viscous puddle of congealing blood and larva entrails, feeling through the gore until I found what I was looking for. The knife. I wiped the blade in my shirt, then pressed its tip against my abdomen, then gripped the handle with both hands. The larva in my gut convulsed, recoiling away from the knife point as if it sensed what I was about to do. I looked up at Liz one last time. A crushing wave of sorrow and loss stole my breath and blurred my vision. She was so selfless and hopeful and brave. All of the things that I wasn't. It was my fault she was dead because I was too much of a coward to face raising a kid. That's what it all came down to. That's why all of this happened, because I was selfish. I didn't want to lose her, to share her with anyone else. I didn't want to let her go. Now I had no choice. She was already gone. We both were. To infinity, I whispered. Then I closed my eyes, held my breath, and started cutting. I hope you enjoyed Baby Food by Warren Benedetto, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Warren-Benedetto. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/WARREN-BENEDETTO. Thanks again for your support of this program, and tonight's featured author. And once again, I'd like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you, personally, for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a new season underway. I hope you had a good time with our new season, and be sure to look ahead to some more lovely stories that'll make your blood run cold. Coming up later in the season will be dips into the swamp, radical radiation and cosmic terrors that you would never want to see awaken from eternal slumber. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else to listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and it would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, well, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back 10 years to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, and our brand new season, stay spooky. Get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?